Good afternoon. Be seated. This is the time for the hearing on our next case. Michael Gibbons is also with my colleagues, Judge Abby Silver and Judge Jerome Tao. We're happy to see all of you here today. Our next matter is the estate of Josephine Ruth Stevenson versus Dr. Harrison and others. This is case 68189. And we have Mr. Killip for the appellant. Am I pronouncing your name correctly? All right, thank you. And who's going to be arguing for the respondents, or both of you?
We'll both be. Okay.
All right, who's going first?
Michael Abitchell for Dr. Harrison.
All right. Okay. All right, Mr. Killip, you can proceed. Would you like to save any time for rebuttal?
I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
May it please the court, as you know, my name is Bill Killip. I'm the counsel for the appellants in this case. Josephine Stevenson, an infant who died in labor in this case, and her parents, Jerry Talley and Jeremy Stevenson. This is an appeal from an order of the district court granting summary judgment. And so obviously we're all familiar with that standard, but I think it bears emphasizing at the outset that the standard here is one of whether or not there was a sufficient issue of fact such that a reasonable fact finder jury in this case could have found in favor of the plaintiff, the appellants. And particularly in this case on a somewhat unique issue of causation that was raised below and that led us here today. This is a case, as the court is aware, involving the attempted delivery and ultimate stillbirth of Josephine Stevenson. There's a number of facts that are either not in dispute or that both sides would agree are legitimate factual issues were the case to be tried. The plaintiff's case was supported below by an affidavit by a well-qualified OBGYN, Dr. Stephen Pine, out of Los Angeles, California. And through his affidavit and through development of the record below, the facts are quickly that Ms. Stevenson was a young lady in her early 20s at the time, presented to Sunrise Hospital, about 9 months pregnant, very, very little, minimal prenatal care, extremely obese, very unsophisticated type of individual, the record pretty clearly indicates. And was about 9 months pregnant, was having pains that appeared to be potentially labor-related, although there was some indication early on that it could have been maybe a gallbladder attack or something was suspected. But in any event, she's kept in the labor and delivery area at Sunrise Hospital for many, many hours. And the record at that point reveals that attempts were made by nurses at Sunrise to do electronic fetal monitoring, and for various reasons those were unsuccessful. There was some indication that the monitors wouldn't stay on. There were other indications that she was having a hard time staying still and the monitors were coming off for that reason. But in any event, the monitors, the monitoring is not very successful. And for
we're pretty familiar with the facts on this, Mr. Carroll.
Right.
Okay, so there's a lot of legal issues in this matter. And if you could first clarify what the plaintiff was asking for in her complaint. You have three different plaintiffs. You have the estate of Josephine and you have each of the parents. So were they seeking different causes, different claims for relief? And also, were you focusing on simply the live birth versus the stillbirth or something beyond that?
Well, as the case developed, let me try to address the first question initially. The case was brought on behalf of all three plaintiffs. Josephine, through the wrongful death statute, and then her parents individually. So the case was pled in that fashion. The causation issue that developed through the expert deposition of Dr. Pine is the one that was kind of bedeviling below, and that was because the evidence indicated that Josephine had a rather severe infection at the time of birth, and that was developed during the findings of the pathologist. And, you know, Dr. Pine's opinion that was well supported was that, look, this pregnancy was one, and then the situation here was one that demanded continuous fetal monitoring.
Well, here's the question, if I can elaborate a little bit more, okay? In your opening brief, you devote almost the whole thing to talking about loss of chance, and the district court focused on loss of chance below, right? Loss of chance only applies if somebody's dead. Now, we know the baby's dead, so the loss of chance claim applies to the baby's estate, but the mom's not dead. So the loss of chance doctrine doesn't apply to her at all.
Right.
What's her injury? Are you saying that her injury is just as the mother of the dead kid and it's emotional injury? She's just standing for the baby, or does she have an independent injury of her own?
She doesn't have an independent physical injury of her own.
Okay. So she's that's good clarification. So she's just basically, the both parents are in this case only as surrogates for the dead baby. Is that their capacity? I don't know if surrogate is the word, but you know what I mean.
Yes.
Because in your complaint, you said she suffered emotional injury, and I wasn't sure if that's something that you're still arguing or not.
Well, she had no physical injury. There was no physical impact, no physical injury. Under the wrongful death statute, she's entitled to recover for her grief and sorrow stemming from the death that occurred.
But the death that occurred, what evidence anywhere in the record would have shown the death occurred be anywhere outside of the ovarian infection? There's nothing else that caused this baby's death that was presented to the district court. I mean, that is causation. I recognize that the doctors vary as to the breach of the standard of care as far as, you know, let's deliver at 7 o'clock at night versus midnight.
Right.
But so obviously they have a difference of opinion as to the standard of care as far as breach. But as far as causation on damages, that there was nothing presented to the district court that we saw in the record that would show that this fetus died of anything other than an ovarian infection. The mother's ovarian infection.
Correct. I mean, there wasn't. That was the evidence that was developed by the pathology that was done, you know, after this.
So that brings me back to the initial question I asked. I mean, what exactly were you seeking damages for? Was it just for the stillbirth, or was it something else?
Well, it was principally for the stillbirth, because the opinion of Dr. Pine was that, look, that any possibility of treating this infection was lost by the fact that the fetal distress in utero or intrapartum fetal distress was not properly recognized and acted upon by Dr. Pine. And so what we wound up with was a stillbirth instead of a live birth, and a situation in which resulted in Ms. Talley then having to, you know, carry this.
Okay, what points and authorities? I mean, I read that, you know, a corpse, delivering a corpse versus a live birth. Either way, live birth and then the child dies. Either way, it's very tragic. But what points, what authorities do you give us to say that there's a cause of action for stillbirth versus live birth that we would remand it back to the district court?
Well,
what did you provide this court with?
Right. I think the issue was one of the, you know, whether or not the fact that this child was born alive versus born deceased, obviously a child born alive could be treated, you know, and may or may not, may have died, may not have died. Child who was born deceased, obviously, or deceased in utero, as was in this case, obviously had no possibility of being treated and resulted in these very tragic, even more tragic consequences for Ms. Talley, in that she had to then carry this child the next day and give birth naturally to the fetus that had deceased.
That's an argument, but what points and what authorities do you have to say that that is a cause of action?
Well, there aren't any, Judge. I can assure you that I've tried to frame that in such a way to emphasize that the you know, that this is a damages issue in terms of the issue of grief, sorrow suffered by a mother under those kinds of circumstances, which can't be, lightly you know, lightly brushed aside under the type of circumstances that took place in this case. So to from my perspective, it's a damages issue, which if believed by the jury, would certainly support a finding on their part, you know, that Ms. Talley underwent, you know, in terms of what she was, you know, what she experienced was something that, you know, that shouldn't have happened and wouldn't have happened had the standard of care been complied with by Dr. Pine and the nurses in this case.
Well, does the loss of chance apply to a live birth versus stillbirth?
I've seen no evidence that it doesn't. I mean, that's you know, the Nevada Supreme Court had to grapple with this issue in the Perez case, looking at cases from around the country and try to come up with some kind of a framework from conflicting authority to arrive at the decision that they did in Perez, and it wasn't clear and it wasn't easy for them to get there.
Well, how did it go in the district court if Perez wasn't even mentioned until the reply briefs in the motion and summary judgment? So motion's filed, you file your response 2 months later, then a reply is filed, Perez is mentioned, then you have your hearing in district court a week later.
Right.
And then the hearing in district court seemed to focus on Perez. And how was it that the earlier briefing didn't?
I think by the time we got to the district court that's kind of what the district judge was focusing on as he was reviewing the record in this case. And I think when one reads the order that was ultimately entered, certainly that was the focus of his
reasoning. Right, but the order only talks about loss of chance as it applies post-birth. In other words, if the child had been born alive, there was no evidence that the child wouldn't have died anyway. I mean, the child was going to die from the infection.
Right.
That the expert couldn't rebut that claim, and so your case seemed to be live birth is what we're talking about, and yet it got changed when you got to the hearing.
Yes. This was not a, you know, this wasn't a simple issue to get to try to frame, and that's certainly where the court seemed to be going and seemed to be focusing at the time in terms of the judge's reasoning when he was looking at the case and determining the basis on which he was going to enter a ruling.
Okay. All right. You have just over 3 minutes. Do you want to reserve the rest of your time there, Mr. Phillip?
I'll reserve the remaining 3 minutes of my time.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. Mr. Navratil, you said you're representing Dr. Harrison, and is it Mr. Bemis for Sunrise?
Right.
Did the two of you agree on how much time each would spend?
We're going to aim for 50-50. Good afternoon, members of the court. Judge Herndon's decision was appropriate and a correct interpretation of Nevada law. NRS 41A-100 provides that liability for personal injury or death is not imposed upon any provider of health care based upon alleged negligence of that care unless there is expert testimony establishing a deviation from the standard of care and causation of the damages or death, and as it would be in this case. And this is a wrongful death case. And it's the absence of the causal link between the alleged malpractice and the death in the case that was fatal to plaintiff's case and the basis for Judge Herndon's decision to grant a summary judgment in favor of the defendants.
Was that fair to do that when the issue was just brought up in the reply to the summary judgment motion? So the plaintiff didn't even have a chance to address it in his response and his opposition, and then a week later after the reply is filed, you have the hearing, and the whole focus of the hearing is on the loss of chance and Perez?
I would argue that that's actually the plaintiff's basis for their opposition to the motion for summary judgment. They didn't present any authority in opposition, as I recall from the pleadings. Mm-hmm. So I think it's perfectly fair. I think it's a perfect interpretation of Nevada law. It's something that was known to the parties going into the hearing.
So why wasn't it in your opening brief then?
If it
was known to everybody, and this is what the whole case was, why wasn't it in the opening summary judgment motion?
Because it wasn't raised until plaintiffs raised the argument, sort of implying that this was a loss of chance case until the reply, and then we responded with the case. We understood this to be a wrongful death case, and that was the basis for the motion for summary judgment. And there was no, and based on Dr. Pine's testimony in his deposition, there was no testimony to a reasonable degree of medical probability that the defendants caused this death. And that was the basis for the motion for summary
judgment. There's no doubt about that. I mean, the testimony is pretty consistent on that point. We don't even have to get to the issue of competing testimony. Right. However, Dr. Pine said pretty in straightforward language that had the monitoring of the fetus started immediately, and he said it should have because it was a high-risk pregnancy, and he gave 9 different reasons why, then it would have been discovered that there was some sort of problem, and therefore they could have done the emergency birth and the child would have been born alive.
Right. And the Perez case requires more than that. The Perez case requires a showing of, to a reasonable degree of medical probability from an expert, that there was a substantial chance of survival given appropriate medical care. And that's where Dr. Pine stops in his testimony. Dr. Pine puts up his hands and says, I can't testify to that. Dr. Pine testifies, I'm not an expert in that area. So Dr. Pine's testimony is basically speculation. It's a what-if type of statement that's not sufficient under Nevada law. It is not a statement stated to a reasonable degree of medical probability as required by Perez and every other case in the medical malpractice.
Right. Right. The medical probability was only to live birth, not to survival after birth.
Correct. And the Nevada wrongful death statute triggers is only triggered upon the death of the patient or the death of the baby. The plaintiffs, the boyfriend and the mother have no standing to bring a claim until there's a death in the case. So anything before, so the claim about this being a stillbirth versus a live birth, that's not, there's no right to recover on that. The right to recover is 41A085, which is the wrongful death statute, which is the loss of consortium from the infant. So whether the baby dies in utero, whether the baby dies...
Well, let me issue this. Let me follow up and
let me just finish that one point. The White case from 1969, the Nevada Supreme Court said that a viable fetus has a claim for wrongful death. In this case, it was a full-term pregnancy. So is that really the issue then? I mean, this child here does have a case if there was malpractice and causation. The question is, as it applies to live birth versus living a full life. The plaintiff presented nothing that this child could have lived a full life, and the malpractice was not related to that. The child had an infection, likely would have died. However, their expert did say the child would have been born alive but for the malpractice.
So the claim in a wrongful death case, the survival statute 41A085 provides that the damages recoverable by the personal representatives of the decedent include special damages such as medical expenses and penalties, which the decedent incurred before the decedent's death. So that didn't happen because the baby was in utero. So that's not an issue. And so and there's also no expert testimony linking the fact that the baby would not have died from the infection. Anyways, and so the absence of that expert testimony is fatal to all of the claims, because without any evidence showing that the doctors and the hospitals that practice caused the baby's death, there's no viable claim. That summary judgment is appropriate, and all the claims are derivative of that action.
What about the mom's injury for damages stemming from experiencing a stillbirth rather than a live birth? I know the question was asked, there's no case law on that, but why wouldn't that be a recoverable injury?
It wasn't pled, number one. This was pled as a wrongful death case. And the alleged injuries are the damages to the mom for the stillbirth.
That's not accurate. The very first claim is medical malpractice, and that the estate is the first plaintiff and asks for pain and suffering and loss of enjoyment of life, and the parents are the second, ask for a separate relief, are seeking damages for mental suffering and anguish.
Related to the stillbirth, related to the death of the infant. And so that is a wrongful death. That is a wrongful death cause of action. So that is why. And again, you still need that causal link. You still need
But the injury here is, it doesn't matter, you know, for loss of chance, there has to be some evidence that maybe the baby would have lived longer. But if the mom's injury is, look, I gave birth to, you know, as the brief says, a corpse rather than a live baby, even if the baby died a second later, why isn't that in and itself a cognizable injury?
I think in that situation, and I think this comes up in the Perez case when they start talking about weighing that loss of chance, weighing the loss of chance type of injury. Here you're talking about the damages from a stillbirth versus the damages of your child dying in a hospital. You're talking about how are you going to weigh that without some sort of causal link, saying that there was something inappropriate that caused this to happen. I mean, you could argue conversely, that your child dying in the hospital could outweigh the stillbirth, the pain and suffering from the stillbirth. Like as Judge Silver said,
right. But the point is,
but
you're weighing tragedies. But that's the jury's. You know, that's the jury's call. If they decide that they haven't suffered any damages, that's the jury's call. But for us to sit here and say, I mean, aren't you asking to say as a matter of law, one is more tragic than the other, and as a matter of law, no one can recover from
it? We're asking to say as a matter of law, when there's uncontested evidence, when there's no argument that the baby wouldn't have died anyway. And that's what we have in this case. We have a situation where this baby was going
to
die anyway.
We're talking about loss of chance. How long the baby lives, even if it died a second after the mom gives birth, right? Why doesn't the mom have a cause of action for that, the baby being dying before or after, no matter how long the baby lived? That's my question.
Not a recognized claim under Nevada law.
Why wouldn't it be?
It's not because of the reasons I just said, Your Honor. There's a weighing of there's going to be a death anyway. The wrongful death statute is an exclusive remedy statute, NRS 41085. It's exclusive remedy for wrongful death type cases. This is a case where the baby was going to die no matter what they did. This was a case, and that's undisputed. They have no expert to contradict that testimony. So again, the damages from a wrongful death are the emotional loss of grief and sorrow. You're going to have those damages either way, no matter what the outcome is in the case. So that would be why it's not a recognized claim, because it's already covered by the wrongful death statute, and it would only apply in a situation where the defendants did something that caused this death to occur. And they didn't. That's not the case here. There's no testimony supporting that, Your Honor. And I've used up much of Mr. Bemis' time, and so...
All right. We'll save the rest of the questions for him. Thank you, Mr. Navratil. You have almost half the time, just a little less than that.
That's all right. I'll try to be brief. I'd like to adopt everything that Mr. Navratil did say. And I represent Sunrise Hospital in this, and I'm happy to be here today. One of the things that I think was just brought up by both Judge Gibbons and Judge Tao is this issue of, I believe you brought up the White case, where a viable fetus has a cause of action. There is no testimony that this was a viable fetus. I think we need to step back and go to square one. Where is the testimony that says this child, this fetus, is viable?
Well, Dr. Pine does say in his deposition it's full term, as far as they know, and this was not an issue that was ever argued as non-viable. I mean, viable means able to live outside of the womb.
Correct.
In their normal circumstances.
But, for example, in this case, this specific case, you're dealing with an individual with an ovarian infection. This was unknown at the time of presentation. It became known after pathology. But what happened is that Dr. Pine looked at this and said, number one, I'm not a pathologist. I can't discuss any of this. I can just say, yeah, that I recognize that. He says, this is the cause of death. It's the ovarian infection. At that point, there's no testimony by Dr. Pine that says this is a viable fetus, that this fetus, this specific fetus, can live outside the womb. Number two.
Well, hold on there. What he is saying is when the mother was checked into the hospital and they did the initial examination a little after 6 o'clock and the child had a heartbeat, he said because it was a high-risk pregnancy, and he listed 9 different reasons in his deposition. You know, I counted them. He said they should have done the internal monitoring, and had they done that, then problems would have been revealed. They didn't start the internal monitoring until actually, they didn't get the order for internal monitoring until 4 hours later, didn't start it for another hour and a half after that. So he said the child would have been born alive. So if the child is born alive, that by definition is a viable fetus.
Well, I'm going to disagree with you on one aspect, because I believe is what Dr. Pine specifically stated was, had I been there, I would have delivered this and handed it off. He never said that this child should have been delivered at this exact time. He said there's a spectrum of time that this child should have been delivered. There is a spectrum of time.
I mean, this is summary judgment. On summary judgment, we take all the testimony and all the inferences from the testimony in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, which means, you know, it sounds like you're trying to say, well, he never says that, and therefore it's not true. But really, in summary judgment, if he never says it, you take it the other way and say it might be true. Isn't that, that's the difference between summary judgment and post-trial appeals.
There is a sense that that would be correct, except for the fact when you're discussing what is said and to a reasonable degree of medical probability. Now, with the medical malpractice case, you have to say, not only, Morsicato tells us, you have to say both standard of care and causation to a reasonable degree of medical probability. And in here, if we want to get into loss of chance or at what point that this child is viable versus not, or this fetus is viable versus non-viable, there is no testimony that says this child is viable at this specific
time. Nobody asked that exact question, of course.
No one exactly.
Because it wasn't an issue in the case because it was a full-term pregnancy.
It wasn't an issue in the case because it became an issue at the opposition to the summary judgment.
Okay. Well, but the problem with you, with nobody asking the question is you're the movement. The burden's on you to show that you're entitled to the judgment as a matter of law. And if nobody asks the question, how are you entitled to judgment as a matter of law?
And in this specific case, I'll tell you that there is no causal link to discuss the fact that there was a injury here caused by these statute or the standard of care criticisms. So he's saying the standard of care would require X, Y, or Z to be delivered, or the fetus to be delivered at this time. The causation would be the injury would not have occurred. The injury would have occurred regardless of that timing. And then it goes into the issue of, it's I believe it's a separate and distinct issue of whether there's a cause of action for a stillbirth with first life. That's not a cause of action that currently exists in the state of Nevada.
Well, let me ask you, about 25 years ago, the Perez case came out. Loss of chance was adopted in Nevada. About 5 years after that, the Greco case came out, and the Supreme Court of Nevada said that loss of chance would apply to a mother deciding whether to exercise her right to abortion. And in that particular case, you know, a child had severe defects and was born that way, and the court affirmed that as a loss of chance case, she lost the chance to decide whether to do an abortion. When, if the doctor had told her about the birth defects, then she could have exercised that if she wanted to. Here, is there a loss of chance to be born alive?
I don't believe that this is the same type of situation that you have there. This time, the case in the Greco matter, you're talking about the loss of chance, the ability to make a choice of whether or not to bring a child full term with the knowing the disabilities. Here, you have an individual that had zero prenatal care, that has no understanding of what is going on with the child inside of her. There is no conscious decision of what is going on and to make a decision to that effect. She comes in, and unbeknownst to her and unbeknownst to the physician, and there's no allegation that anybody should have known, she had a massive ovarian infection. So it's completely distinct and separate matters here.
Right, but Dr. Pine does say that he thinks emergency birth process could have been done and the child would have been born alive. Now, whether his opinion is right is totally contradicted by the defense expert, but again, on summary judgment, does that really matter?
But I think that you're talking about a separate cause that has not been recognized of a stillbirth versus live birth, and at that point, you have to look to see if is this a viable? Is this a viable fetus?
Okay. Well, I don't think I would hang my hat on that argument when it's a full-term pregnancy.
Well, in this case, I wouldn't hang my hat on the issue of whether this is a viable because of the fact that you have a massive infection and a child that is admittedly infected and is all the testimony says this child would have died anyways. So whether there's one breath, zero breaths, they would have lived through childbirth. I think that Judge Herndon specifically mentions that in the order and says that this can't apply because there is absolutely zero discussion about this and there's an opportunity to bring out the individuals that could discuss this type of medical causation, which was never brought out by plaintiffs, and it's their burden to bring that out when it comes to prosecuting a medical malpractice case, and especially in light of the complications when it comes to knowing having the autopsy report and knowing this is an infected child.
Okay. So you don't see this case then as a damages issue at all, that even though the child had apparently fatal sickness, that the question of how long the child would have lived after birth doesn't really matter. It's just that the child would have died anyway.
Well, when it comes down to it, there's got to be the Perez case has a reasonable chance of survival.
Right. And here you clearly have that in this case in your favor. But the doctor, again, said child would have been born alive had they engaged in the proper process. He thinks there was malpractice.
He believes that, and he didn't be able to make any causal link to the ultimate damages.
Other than characterizing it as loss of chance to be born alive.
Well, loss of chance to be born alive is not a recognized cause of action, but from the action, if you want to bring it back to Perez, then it'd be survivability.
All right. Well, we asked the appellant's attorney if he had any case law on that. I mean, do you have any case law to support your proposition that there is no cause of action for the loss of chance to be born alive?
The absence of case law would be the case law that there is, the complete absence of it when it comes to the issue of whether the child would, or the loss of chance of born alive. But if you ferret it out into the Perez argument, and Perez specifically says, when it says, in order to create a question of fact regarding causation in these cases, the plaintiff must present evidence tending to show to a reasonable degree of medical probability that some negligent act or omission by healthcare providers reduced a substantial chance of survival given appropriate medical care. The terminology would be survival. And they specifically used that language. And then here, there is no question on the issue of survival.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bemis.
Thank you for your time.
All right, Mr. Killip, you have just over 3 minutes left.
I have a little time on rebuttal, Your Honor, and I'll use that to point out primarily, obviously I'll respond to any other questions as best I can that you may have, but to that I do need to stand corrected on an issue that I inaccurately responded to, I think, to Judge Tao initially and potentially others, which is that, you know, the way this case was pled, in fact, it was pled as a wrongful death case, and also in particular, paragraph 35 of the complaint, page 18 of the joint appendix, also on behalf of plaintiff, mother and father, pain, mental suffering, anguish after the birth of their dead son, all to the damage of plaintiffs in the amount of excess of $10,000. So it was pled not only simply as a wrongful death case, but also as an independent cause of action on behalf of mother and father, which I think relates to the issue that we've been sort of grappling with all afternoon about the issue of being born alive versus being born not alive, as distinct from the issue of what the survivability or the chances of living a normal life versus some shortened lifespan would have been in that respect. So I would like to point out that I misspoke earlier with regard to the record on that particular issue. with that, I don't know that I have anything else really to add to my earlier remarks, unless the court has any further.
Well, you've just heard the argument here. Mr. Bemis says there's no evidence that was a viable child, and I mean, obviously it was 9 months, right. So I think he must mean that the child would have lived because the child had this serious infection.
Right.
So in light of the serious infection, was the child still viable?
Well, viability, you know, this was a full term fetus. I mean, there was no evidence that this was
I think the child was 9.5 pounds, if I remember right. I mean, that's bigger than all three of my kids.
Right. This was a large, you know, full size, you know, large baby, full term pregnancy.
Well, they're bigger than both of mine. Yeah. And I'm the only one that delivered here, by the way.
Right.
But,
So
what evidence, I mean, all there was the coroner's report that this infection was 2 days old.
Right.
There was nothing presented by plaintiff that as to viability of this child, and Judge Hernan's order about competency. Obviously, Dr. Pine is incompetent to testify as a pediatrician. He acknowledged that.
Right.
As to viability, and therefore, there's what evidence are we to look for causation?
Right.
Under any theory.
Right. I mean that's the issue of you know that we can't say what the long term prospects would have been for this baby. Would the lifespan have been a matter of, you know, days versus hours versus a normal lifespan? All we can really say is that there would have been, from our perspective, a live birth as opposed to a stillbirth. And I think that's well supported by Dr. Pine's testimony and made relevant by what the court alluded to earlier and what I clarified a moment ago about the manner in which the case was pled below.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Killip. This matter will stand submitted. Good job by all the counsel. This is a challenging situation, and we've had to look at cases over the last 150 years on life and other related issues, and then the more recent cases on causation. And we appreciate that all of you were available for oral argument on relatively short notice. All right, so this matter will stand submitted.